Well, I actually can be embarrassed. That was more than gracious by way of introduction. Thank you very much for all the kind words. I once introduced somebody saying I was going to embarrass him with praise, and he said, I'm man enough to take it. Well, so am I, but thank you. It's really terrific to be back in Freiburg. I spent almost a month here 26 years ago at the Max Planck Institute, where we assembled 20 German scholars and 20 American and English scholars of criminal law and criminal law theory for a three-week powwow on what we had in common and where we differed. And both personally and professionally, that was some of the best time I've ever had. I have lifelong friends, both in Germany and elsewhere, but really good colleagues as well. Extremely formative influence on many of our careers. I'm one of the last survivors. Most have either had the good sense to retire or the unfortunate lack of good sense to die, but there are still a few of us around from that conference. Anyway, my topic is mechanical brains, responsible choices. It is an interdisciplinary topic. It aims to relate the most recent findings, including those in Berlin in the last 2 years, on neuroscience to the topic that is as old as philosophy, which is our responsibility for our actions and the consequences that they cause. I have been graced with a grant from the MacArthur Foundation in America. I and some friends of mine applied for a grant on precisely this topic some years ago, showing the truth of the old saying that if you apply for one heck of a lot of money, sometimes you get a heck of a lot. We asked for $70 million. We only got 10, but we've been doing well with our $10 million in investigating this topic through a series of research groups. I am head of what we call colloquially the Big Think research group. That's the one that deals with issues like this. What is the compatibility of the neuroscientific findings with the issues of the human spirit, as the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. once said? We have lots of much more discrete topics with many more research groups dealing with much more particular topics, some of them relating to responsibility. What's the neuroscience of habitual behavior, for example? Tell us about the voluntariness of that behavior for responsibility attribution. So we have a good number of particular groups, but what interests me is the kind of topic that we're going to address tonight. The challenges from neuroscience, I think, are not new. They've been with us ever since Hobbesian materialism became a viable philosophy. They are particularly evident in the work of the person with whom, since I started a long time ago, I began studying, which was Freudian theory. Remember when Freud says we are not masters in our own house? He used his own insights about dynamic psychiatry, the dynamic unconscious, to challenge what he regarded as the archaic supposition of lawyers about the free will that made us responsible. That's a topic on which my first paper was called The Wish to Bleed, 1966. Which was a send-up of Freudian dream theory on the supposition that nobody would explain bleeding by an unconscious wish to bleed, and similarly no one should explain dreaming by an unconscious wish to sleep, which was half of the wish fulfillment dream theory of Freud. I see some smiles. We all smile at psychoanalysis these days. Here's the trick. The science is a lot better. The challenges are about the same. The issue is whether or not the scientific advances we've made in the last 50 years in psychology make any difference with respect to the degree to which the law and the morality on which the law is built actually is vulnerable to those challenges. If you can't stand the suspense, I'm here to tell you that it's going to be okay by the end of the lecture. Here's what I'd like to do organizationally. I'd like to lay out what is being challenged by neuroscience, as by previous psychologies, be they behaviorist, dynamic, psychiatric, or Hobbesian materialism. What is being challenged? What's the data that's doing the challenging, secondly? Thirdly, what kind of challenges does that data actually mount, at least plausibly? And then fourthly, the body of the remarks will really be on assessing how good the challenges are to the ordinary suppositions we have about responsibility. I'm trying to talk slowly because my natural tendency is to really talk much more quickly. So, if I start to talk too quickly, just slow me down. Okay, topic number one. What is it that's being challenged? Three sorts of things. First and foremost, certain kinds of legal institutions. Many of us here have at least one hat in the legal academy, and we care about the design of legal institutions. In my case, in particular, punishment institutions. Any institution, but including that of the criminal law, that is built on the moral desert of those to whom the law applies, has some interest in the suppositions that seemingly are challenged by neuroscience. That certainly includes retributive punishment theorists like myself. It also includes mixed punishment theorists, punishment theorists for whom desert is a necessary but not a sufficient condition of legal sanction. It does amuse me that one of the people who approved our funding was Robert Sapolsky, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist. I know he hoped we were going to discover a way to get rid of the retributive theory of punishment. He's probably quite disappointed that I had a study group that's aimed precisely at keeping it. But nonetheless, one of the things that would be vulnerable would be a retributive or even a mixed theory of punishment, or any other theory of law, such as the natural rights theory of property, from John Locke to Robert Nozick, or the promissory theory of contracts, or the corrective justice theory of torts, each of which makes legal liability turn on the moral desert of those to whom the legal sanction would be applied. All of those are seemingly hostage to the kind of neuroscientific challenges I want to examine. So legal institutions are vulnerable. The morality on which they're built is also vulnerable. The morality that judges whether or not you're responsible in everyday life for the good things and the bad things that you seemingly cause. More basic than that, thirdly, not just legal institutions and the morality on which it's built, but I think as Ralph was adverting to, our very self-understanding is seemingly threatened by the neuroscience of today in a way that has made this the issue, the grist for popular magazines, not just in America, but I think around the world. It's a popular psychology that we have developed over the last 2,000 years that is so ingrained in us we hardly think about it. And yet if we were to lose it, as my colleague Jerry Fodor in philosophy says, it would be the greatest catastrophe since the beginning of time. It's inconceivable, he thinks, that we would lose it. We would become, as Manfred Bleuler said, the famous Swiss psychiatrist who first diagnosed schizophrenia in 1912. He said, we would become stranger than the birds in our garden if we were to lose this psychology. What is the psychology? First and foremost, it is that we act under certain representational states. What the scholastics of the Middle Ages called intentionality with a capital I, revived by Franz Brentano in the 19th century, one of Freud's teachers. We have mental states that are directed upon objects that do not mean objects in the real world, but representations of those objects. We are intentional creatures in that sense. Secondly, in the explanation of rational action, there are three such states, three modalities of representational states that dominate. What we motivationally desire, what we cognitively believe, and what we cognitively will, or if you like, intend. That's as old as Plato's tripartite division of the soul and as modern artificial intelligence and cognitive science. Three sorts of states. Thirdly, that psychology has built into it what Aristotle called a practical syllogism. It's not just three states in any order, but rational action follows a certain pattern, a pattern we know so well that we don't cite it very often in full. We only cite a piece of it, but we all understand immediately what the full syllogism would look like. There's a motivational major premise of what it is that you want, a cognitive minor premise about the believed means by action to get what you want. And the conclusion, contra Aristotle, isn't action, it's an intention, according to many philosophers of mind. So, you desired to learn something about neuroscience, you believed if you came here tonight you might, therefore you intended to come, and therefore you came. Three states entering into the rational explanation of why you're still sitting here. In terms of these representational states. Notice the content of the states has to bear a certain relation for the practical syllogism to be, as Aristotle said, a valid one. Fourthly, those representational states, we think, cause the behavior that is part of their objects. The intention to act causes the person to do the action which is the object of his intention. That's the way in which we can shape the world to match our representations, rather than simply having a world matched by our representations of beliefs, because that's the way it is. We think we have autonomy in the sense that we can change the world to conform to how we want it to be and intend it to be, and not just how we believe it already is. There's causal efficacy to the representational states. Fifthly, there is this troublesome item of freedom. In some sense, we want our actions to be free. The trick is specifying the sense. It's not just we think act in accordance with right reason, Kantian freedom, more like what Mill had in mind, perhaps, where you're not simply a steam engine, but you are, as he put it, a self-made creature. Something like that in the way of freedom. Sixthly, we want the states to be part of our self. Locke said the criterion for self is consciousness. What makes a state part of our self, that unifies us, that makes it care about it as part of us, is that we experience a unity of consciousness that makes it all the state of one being, namely ourself. And seventhly, as the common law lawyers used to say in their cases, there's a realism about mental states built into this psychology, a realism that says, to quote an old common law case from England, the state of a man's mind is as real as the state of his digestion. If you don't think that, then we're also really in trouble. I think it's really presupposed by the previous six. Now, that's what's commonly called in philosophy of mind the folk psychology, the psychology of the folk, the popular psychology before you become scientific, on which moral ascriptions of both praise and blame are built, and on which those legal institutions that utilize those moral ascriptions and praise and blame is also built. Those are the three things seemingly challenged by the data of neuroscience. Second topic, what's the data doing the challenging? One of the first things we did in the MacArthur Foundation was order up literature reviews of various things. One of those was, say, 1900, 1965, what was learned about voluntary motor movements in psychology. There is a long and nice set of literature well established from Sherrington at the turn of the century, turn of the last century, on up, detailing how the motor plates on the muscles go through the common final motor pathway that go up the spine to the two kinds of pathways there are, the upper motor pathways, up to the primary motor cortex. And now the story gets interesting. Because after 1965, particularly built on some research in Germany, we didn't have fMRI, functional magnetic resonance, it was EEG studies. There was discovered in Germany what came to be called, it wasn't called it initially, a readiness potential. Namely, if you put an electric device on the vertex of the scalp, for voluntary motor movement, going through one of the upper motor pathways, for voluntary motor movement, there would be a slow negative shift in electrical potential that was systematic and detectable about 1 second prior to movement. Became known as the readiness potential. The finding, and it presumably, as we would later come to see, originates in the supplementary motor area of the brain. That finding sat still for about 20 years. A colleague of mine in the University of California system across the bay, I was teaching at Berkeley, Benjamin Libet, had spent his entire life as a psychologist doing consciousness studies. Studies of trying to make respectable something that in psychology, scientific psychology, hadn't been respectable for some time. Studies of consciousness. What he did was take the German research and pair it with consciousness studies so that he designed the following kinds of experiments. He had a series of different types focused just on what he called type 2 readiness potential. The subjects in the famous experiments replicated many times have been told not to pre-plan, and they're not given a direction when to do some very simple action, typically either flex a wrist, press a finger. They are giving a rotating clock so that they can time various items that we care about. They have an electrode on the top of their scalp measuring readiness potential. For this class of actions, the readiness potential is about 550 milliseconds, not 1,000 milliseconds, prior to the electric current hitting the plates on the motors, on the muscles, the motor plates on the muscles. So 550 milliseconds prior to the initiation of movement, there is a readiness potential, presumably in the supplementary motor area of the brain. What interested Libet was his consciousness studies. So he asked the subjects in watching the rotating clock to time when it was they became aware of their decision to move their finger. And that regularly came in at about 200 milliseconds prior to movement initiation, which is 350 milliseconds after the readiness potential in the brain. Now, that study was first done and published in 1983. There was a lovely commentary by many brain scientists in 1985 in Brains and Behavior, the Cambridge peer-reviewed journal, and then replicated many times by people like Paul Haggard at London. It was given a dramatic expression in a book by a Harvard psychologist, Daniel Wegner, called The Illusion of Conscious Will, tells you which way he goes, and done most recently extended by a fellow called John Dylan Haynes, who does his research mostly in Berlin, partly in London. John Dylan, I commented on at UC Santa Barbara. We flew him over to the Sage Center for the Study of Human Mind to come talk to us about his research. He's the one you may have read about in the papers who does the new mind reader, he's called. His findings are very striking. He says, let's leave the supplementary motor area. Let's move back further up the chain in terms of the rational decision leading to action, particularly in the precuneus of the parietal cortex. And let's make the decisions extended so we can see for a longer period what's going on. John Dylan, incidentally, hyphens, he's not English, he's German, so he hyphens it up front. It's John hyphen Dylan, he was careful to tell me. In any event, John Dylan says, let's go to the precuneus of the parietal cortex and see what's going on for decisions that we're going to artificially extend. He has two experiments, one last year, one the year before. One of them is the decision is whether you're going to add or subtract once the experimenter gives you some numbers to do it with, but you make your decision first. You sit there for 25 seconds and make up your mind. Eventually, you get the numbers and you'll add or subtract. The other is another button pushing with a flexing of one of your fingers. He likes the first better than the second because it gets all the motor area stuff out of the way. There's no motor movement in a mental action of deciding to add or subtract. Here's the striking finding the magazines have so picked up on. John Dylan is currently at a 71% accuracy rate of telling you 7 to 10 seconds prior to you knowing what your decision is, what it is. Namely, he can read from fMRI in that region of the brain. It's only 71% so far. He's sure he's hoping to do better. Whether you're going to add or subtract before you know you're going to add or subtract. The dating of the awareness of the decision, it's not done by a rotating clock. It's a series of letters that he uses, same sort of idea. The subjects date as accurately they can when they decide it, according to them. Okay, here's what's supposed to come out of the Libet to Haynes research program. As John Dylan says, just as Benjamin Libet did, the brain's already decided. You were kind of left out. The brain's made its decision. All you do is get to see what's decided. That sounds pretty threatening. The way Libet put it in one of his articles on free will, and unfortunately, he left being a good scientific researcher and became a philosopher. The way he put it in an article of his called Free Will is, if the act now process is initiated unconsciously, then conscious free will is not doing it. Here I want to move to my third topic, which is what philosophers always do to what everybody else says. You divide it up in a way that they wouldn't recognize. It's part of the old divide and conquer strategy. I do think analytically, Libet and John Dylan Haynes have elided separate claims together. If we pull them apart, I don't think they'll look as good as they did if they're all smushed together. So what I want to do is divide this up into six claims, but since that's an unmanageable number, let's divide it into two families. Family number one is the claim that comes from the insight that the mental choice or willing or intending, whatever you want to call it, is caused by factors themselves unchosen. That, I think, is rightly called the determinist challenge, broadly put. The insight is your choices are caused by factors you can't control. The second insight is quite different. It's often confused, but it's quite different. It's what I call the epiphenomenalist challenge. Epiphenomena is one of those big philosophical words. When my daughter was an undergraduate with me at Berkeley, when I was teaching there, she used to come in for the word of the week. Epiphenomena was one of the words of the week. I used to run in the morning when I was younger and in better shape. Indeed, I used to run these hills every day when I was here. Two things would happen. Since I would run with my dog was in better shape than I was. So I would get tired, and then my dog would get tired. Those are the horns of an epiphenomenal fork, i.e. they have a common cause, the running. But it looks, since I always got tired before my dog got tired, that you might say that my running and getting tired, rather my getting tired, caused my dog to get tired. It didn't. They are epiphenomenal with each other, which means they do not have a causal relationship. They only look like they have a causal relationship because they're co-effects of a common cause. The epiphenomenal challenges are based on the view that although our conscious decisions look like they're causing the behavior that are their objects, they are really epiphenomenal with those behaviors. They are simply co-effects of a common cause, the common cause being the readiness potential in a supplementary motor area or even further back, the intending done back in the precuneus of the parietal cortex. That what really is doing the causing are those brain events. It just looks like you are doing some causing. You may remember Freud used to talk about the ego being the rider on the horse. He had the same epiphenomenal sort of challenge. It's the rider on the horse who thinks he's holding some reins, but actually the horse doesn't pay any attention to him. He's just there for the ride, was Freud's notion of epiphenomena. Now, I subdivide each of these two families into three different challenges. Rather than lay those out, let me go through them as I assess them, because it's easier to do it once rather than twice. So, I now get to get to the body of what I want to talk about, which is the challenges themselves in terms of how persuasive they are that the common sense psychology we've lived with for 2,000 years and the morality and the law built upon it can't be sustained. So, determinist challenges. The challenge that says our choices are caused. There are three versions of that, and how you individuate arguments is inherently arbitrary. When you hear them, if you want to dice it up another way, feel free. But I think there's three that make sense to discuss separately. The first comes from a thought that choice to be choice cannot be caused. So this is going to be a necessity claim. It's going to be a claim that for something to be choice, it can't be caused, at least it can't be caused by factors themselves unchosen, like unconscious events going on in your precuneus, the parietal cortex. That's a claim about necessity, about choice. Think about a threat. Gunman puts a gun at your head, the argument is. It is common in English to say, well, you had no choice. You had to give over your money. The insight is supposed to be, if choice is caused, it ceases being choice. Well, that's an easy incompatibility with responsibility and choice, if that's true. Because the moment you say it's caused, well, then it's not really a choice, and we've lost one of the three representational states at the heart of our common sense psychology. Now, that is a damn peculiar claim. Think of it this way. I was giving a lecture on free will at Northwestern University in America many years ago. There's a nice lake out there called Lake Michigan. Somebody made this argument, which is why it's in here. So I looked out at the lake, and I said, let's explain the lake in terms of the causes for why it's there. I don't know much geology, so it was pretty quick. Glaciation, water table, that's about it. Water. There, it's caused us. So I said to the objector, I said, now look out there again. Did it go away? Or is it still there? Is Lake Michigan still there, and is it still a lake despite being caused? Now, actually, these demonstrative exercises can be insulting. For him, the lake disappeared because he was so insulted he turned his back and walked out of the room. But for the rest of us, the lake actually was still there. To explain something usually is not to explain it away. So that to explain choice is not, prima facie, to make it disappear. So the burden is on someone who raises this objection to say, yeah, but choices are not lakes. It's necessarily the case with choices that they are uncaused. It's either analytically necessary, it's by the very conventions that give the words their meaning, that choice has to be uncaused. It's sort of like a bachelor is unmarried. It's not a contingent truth, it's analytically necessary. If you get married, you're not a bachelor anymore. If a choice is caused, it's not a choice anymore. Or it's metaphysically necessary. Lack of causation is an essential property of choices, even if it's not analytically a necessary condition, has to be the claim. Now, on their face, neither of those seem very intuitive. Without getting technical, just consider this example. I once had a colleague, like many of us, he did one thing in his life that he was really proud of. He was a law professor. He had served in a high level in the Truman administration, President Truman, after World War II. He unfortunately, like many people who get old, lose track of the stories they tell. He'd tell the same damn boring stories at lunch. So it became a joke amongst the younger faculty. See how subtle an allusion you could make to Truman and get him to tell one of those boring stories. Say something like, I drove through Independence, Missouri yesterday, which was Truman's hometown, and you'd get one of the three really boring stories. Homely point. I think I caused him, when I told what I said, to choose to tell us one of the boring stories. Indeed, I think he's fully responsible. There isn't a crime in the Kansas Criminal Code, which is where I was, for boring your colleagues at lunch. It's not criminal, but you can still blame people for doing something that they chose to do, and notice it's a choice I seemingly caused. So it's not obvious at all that choices can't be caused. There's a much better objection. It's going to be one of the later ones I come to, which is that choices can be caused. What they eliminate is not choice. They eliminate the responsibility for the choice. That's a better challenge, because the first one undertakes what seemingly is an impossible burden. You can't have choices if they're caused. You're either going to show that analytically, or you're going to show it as a metaphysically essential property. Neither of those seem very plausible. So let me come to the second version of the determinist challenge. Remember again, the family's defined by working with the causation of choice as somehow challenging responsibility. Okay? This one goes like this. If you look at the long story we now know to be true about voluntary motor movement, it's all at the level of physical systems doing their physical things, from the motor plates on the muscles all the way through their motor pathways into the brain. For choices to do some causing, unless you're one of those strange holdouts who think that immaterial minds can cause neurons to discharge, there are some people who still think that. One of them even has a Nobel Prize, Sir John Eccles. But nonetheless, that to most of us looks, it's a technical word, it looks crazy to think that an immaterial mind that is not located in space can have causal relations with something located in space and time. So if that's not possible, then it must be that choice itself is a physical process, a brain process of some sort. So now the worry is not about choice being explained causally. The worry is choice being reduced, being shown to be identical with a physical process. Now, how does that lead to skepticism? I first ran into this version of skepticism when I was doing grand rounds presentations at medical centers in the United States in the early 1970s. My opponent, because they were debates, was Thomas Szasz, the Hungarian psychiatrist who wrote a book that was then a popular book called The Myth of Mental Illness. Tom's argument went like this. Suppose the hope of 19th century psychiatry were to be realized, that for every mental illness, there was a brain condition. His example actually was the syphilis that gives rise to general paresis years later. Presumably that's what took care of Nietzsche in 1889, was syphilis contracted during the Franco-Prussian War, his example. So, if that were realized, Szasz said, well then there wouldn't be any mental illness. There'd only be brain disease. Now think about that for a minute. That is also a very peculiar claim. That's to say, if you can identify mental illness with brain disease, then there isn't such a thing as mental illness. Identity claims don't work like that. Identity claims do not eliminate the thing with which you've identified one thing with another. Usually when you identify water as H2O, you don't say there's no water. You simply say water has a nature, two of hydrogen, one of oxygen, rather than saying there's no such thing as water. So you need an argument as to why this kind of an identity claim should give rise to any form of skepticism. So, one of my colleagues is Josh Green. He's a lot younger than I am, has a nice chair at Harvard, does research on brain items, although he's a philosopher. Here's Josh's, in one of his articles, attempt to convince you that this identity leads to elimination. He says, imagine you're at lunch and trying to choose between soup and salad. It's a soup-salad choice. And now he makes up the brain science, but it doesn't matter. Just any dumb mechanical story will do. He says, suppose the soup salad choice is fully determined by whether the soup inclining neurons fire more frequently than the salad inclining neurons in some area of the brain. And since we can stain these things any damn color we like in the fMRI printouts, if it's tomato soup, let's make the soup ones red, and if it's salad, let's make the salad ones green. So now Josh has for his readers in this article, published in a very respectable British journal, a picture of the brain that looks sort of like a Kurosawa movie. You know those Japanese films where the big flags come in and the battles are determined by the biggest flags beating down the others? He's got a Kurosawa movie going on in the brain determining whether you have soup or salad, and what he wants you to think is that you just got left out of the story. I call this the disappearing agent intuition. There's a battle between these green neurons and these red neurons, and the outcome is fully determined by them, but if you were to be responsible, you should be somewhere down on that battlefield. If the salad choice is yours, you should be leading the green troops to victory down on the battle. Now, of course, that's preposterous, because you are not to be put down on the battlefield. As I've said to Josh, you are the battlefield. You are the entire arena in which this is taking place. So the person who gets skeptical from the identity claim, from the reductionist claim of mental states to brain states, has to say something like, but surprising identities of this kind eliminate the thing reduced. There are people who think that. If the identities get surprising enough, but think how counterintuitive that is. Before we knew anything much about what lay behind the ideal gas theory, we only knew the macro behavior of gases. Who would have thought the heat of a gas was all these almost perfectly elastic little billiard balls bouncing against each other, the mean kinetic energy of the molecules being the heat? Who would have thought that? It's extremely surprising. Or take an example in psychology. Who would have thought that dreaming, which we knew for thousands of years by one route only, which is we had waking remembrances whose content we knew did not happen. That was our criterion of dreaming, and then two psychologists in the 1950s, Demet and Kleitman, did rapid eye movement studies and EEG pattern studies and found out an awful lot about the brainwave oscillations and the rapid eye movements that seemingly were either expressions of or part of dreaming. It seemed like dreaming didn't disappear, although there was a famous book by a Wittgensteinian philosopher named Norman Malcolm called Dreaming, 1959, which argued precisely that. These findings weren't about dreaming, it was about schmeeming, because dreaming couldn't have a nature that surprising and still be dreaming. That's to have a view about what must be the conceptual essence of dreaming that just seems false. Dreaming surely had such a nature. That's a book that is much forgotten, now used only as an example of what you don't want to say. Is there anything about human agency that makes it unlike dreaming or water or heat or all these other things that if you identify them with surprising base properties, nonetheless, it still exists? Hilary Putnam, my long colleague and former teacher in philosophy language, used to use this example. He used to say, suppose it turns out pencils are not things manufactured in factories. They're really spies from Mars. They don't want to be detected, so they sit very still and they write just like they're supposed to. But really, they have full practical syllogisms. They desire not to be detected, believe if they perform as they're supposed to and keep quiet about it, we'll never figure out they're spies from Mars. This isn't true. What if it were true? Would we then say there were no pencils? Putnam thinks the answer, of course not. The identity which really surprises us is rather pencils have a very different nature than we thought they did. Who would have thought our decisions look like a Kurosawa movie, if that's what it turns out to be? All these two-valued switches going off in complicated patterns. That's not how we initially came to know the phenomenon of choice. It's not how we initially came to know heat or lots of other things that science has surprised us with as well. Think about the alternative. The alternative to such reduction would be a kind of irreducible homunculus in the brain, which, as Skinner used to always say, explains nothing. Because if you've got a homunculus, if you don't like psychology, how about popular films? Woody Allen's film, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex. It has Burt Reynolds up in the control panels directing Woody down below when he's ready to go. And Burt's got a lot of functions he's performing, pulling the levers up in the brain and so forth. It's got lots of sexual innuendo I won't bore you with. Skinner would say, but who's in Burt's brain? Is there a little Burt in Burt's brain? In which event, you have an infinite regress of homunculi. Or you don't. But in either case, you haven't explained anything. You haven't explained the intentionality of the homunculi if you posit little ones and little ones and little ones. So the result is, even if it's surprising, this is not an identity that should make you skeptical about the thing with which you identify brain processes, namely mental states like intention. So notice, this second sort of objection loses because of its strength as well. The first one said a choice can't be caused and still be a choice. The second one says a choice can't be identical with brain states and still be a choice. Those are surely armchair science at its worst. Now try a third version. The true determinist objection is this one. If the brain scientists in Berlin or anywhere else can show us that our choices are caused by factors that we do not control, because we're not aware of them, then they will have shown us that we could not have done other than we did. That challenge has been around for a very long time. But so has its answer. And although we don't have time tonight, the compatibilists amongst us, which is me for my entire career, there are quite a few books that articulate one of two, or sometimes both, compatibilist strategies. One is to say it doesn't matter if you could not have done otherwise. This is a strategy mostly associated with the work of Harry Frankfurt, where you imagine a redundancy mechanism. Suppose it's the case, I really want you to slap your neighbor. I think you're probably going to do it anyway. But if I read your brain to see that you're not, when Frankfurt made these up, this was fanciful. It's not fanciful anymore. I can use transcranial magnetic stimulation, not to cause your movement. I can do that too. But I'm going to put it further back. I'm going to make you want to slap your neighbor, and then you're going to slap him. Suppose that's the case. So I've got transcranial magnetic stimulation devices on each of your brain, but nonetheless, you each slap each other. I never used them. It wouldn't have made any difference had you decided not to. You still would have, given the devices set up next to you. From which Frankfurt wants to say, and those who go this route, it doesn't matter that you couldn't have done otherwise. You're responsible because you're the author of what happened anyway. It doesn't matter that you couldn't have done otherwise, which is what these examples are supposed to show. The other route is this one. The language of possibility, the language of could have done otherwise, of he can or cannot do something, the language of ability, is notoriously ambiguous between senses clearly compatible with the exercises of those abilities being fully caused, and senses that are perhaps incompatible. We have two senses of the words. If we don't have two senses, it's because we don't have an incompatibilist sense. We clearly have a compatibilist sense. The coach who says to his racer, "You could have won the race," he doesn't mean there weren't causes sufficient for the racer to have lost. He simply means you could have if you had tried harder. If among the causes that were making you run was an attempt to really win the race more than you were attempting it, you would have won the race. That's compatible with fully caused loss of the race. Now, the colleague that I mentioned who served in the Truman administration could have refrained from telling us that boring story that I elicited at lunch. I know because I tested it. Namely, he had another idée fixée. Besides the Truman administration, he was assigned to teach legal writing, which in American law schools is a kind of insult to a senior professor. It's a junior course. So that became something that he was obsessive about as well. So I tried this sentence at lunch one day. Did you know that President Truman once taught legal writing? I wanted to see which way it would go. And the reason I know he could have not told the story isn't because he went after the legal writing. He didn't whine about legal writing any more than he told us about Truman. He actually broke free and said, "He did? Really? I didn't know that." Looked like he could have not told the boring story if he had actually tried not to do so. He had the capacity, in the compatibilist sense of capacity. One of the things you try to do when you argue in philosophy is to show why the opponent's position seems plausible. So let me shift gears and try that. Why do incompatibilists sound plausible with their examples? That's because in their examples, typically more than simply causation of choice is involved. So try some examples from philosophy literature. Does it tempt you at all when David Hume tells you as he did? He said, I make a wager with you, when he was talking about the predictability of human behavior. Go to Charing Cross Station in central London, his example. Put a pot of gold in the street and then stand to the side. See how long it stays. My prediction, the greedy desires of virtually the first passersby will take the gold, will cause them to take the gold. Does it make you skeptical about the responsibility of the persons whose greedy choices, whose desires for more money cause them to take the gold? Contrast that with at least the temptations to excuse in a play like Othello. So Othello kills Desdemona out of a fit of jealous anger, inspired by Iago having falsely told him that she's been unfaithful. It may not be much of an excuse. Aristotle thought it was a crappy excuse. But nonetheless, the criminal law of Anglo-American systems give you a provocation defense that mitigates you down. Why would that be? It isn't because Iago caused the beliefs. It's rather because the anger that gives rise to the behavior is, at least by those who read more Freud than Aristotle, thought to be ego alien, the kind of thing that attacks reason, that incapacitates reason, and so reason control is less possible. Whether you think the story is true or false, you only need to see the drift of the story to see why there's a tendency to excuse Othello in a way you would not excuse the person who takes Hume's pot of gold. Or take any of the other kinds of examples people raise. Suppose you juxtapose to my ordinary suggestion about Truman a post-hypnotic or hypnotic suggestion. Why is it we tend to think hypnosis excuses, it's just suggestions, but ordinary suggestions do not? It's because we tend to think that in hypnosis or even in post-hypnotic suggestiveness, there is an incapacitation of the ability to guide the behavior by reason. I used to take my elder children, I was teaching in Los Angeles at USC, up to a place called Pat the Hipped Hypnotist. And she would put on a show, quite amusing, because she'd get people to do the stupidest things. And then she'd ask them why they did it. And as long as she didn't pick on a lawyer, because we all know lawyers make up things, as long as she didn't pick on a lawyer, people honestly would reply, I don't know. I don't know why the behavior was done. It actually, the recent study from Paul Haggard in London, shows that quite far up into the brain, as far as we've been able to study, the motion looks for all the world like a voluntary motion. But it looks disconnected somewhere higher up from reason, because it's completely cut off from the reasoning ability of the actor. In which event, you might well say about behavior in response to post-hypnotic suggestion, it's an incapacitation. It's not just that it's caused by the suggestion, it's more specifically caused by the suggestion through an incapacitation of the control functions that allow reason to guide our behavior. It does, that's an excuse. Or consider the case we all used in criminal law years ago when Patty Hearst was kidnapped. We are all coercively indoctrinated in a sense. We don't choose who teaches us or what they teach us. It has a causal impact on what we believe. I hope I'm having a lot now. But that's a lot different than locking you in a closet for 3 weeks and coercively indoctrinating you, not because that's more causal, but rather because it is thought, given the complete gestalt switch that Patty did on emerging from the closet, that she was in an altered or fugue state so that her capacities for control were impaired. The jury didn't believe the story, but at least you could see the kind of story that would tend you towards excuse. Now try a really hard case. This is the one we discussed in the MacArthur Foundation 2 years ago. 3 years ago at the University of Virginia, an ordinary, middle-class, well-to-do American came in because he had just served some time in jail. But it was odd for him. He'd had a perfectly normal life, but all of a sudden he had experienced some sexual urges towards children, which he never had had before, and he'd engaged in some inappropriate touching of his minor stepdaughter, so they put him in jail. He came into the University of Virginia. It's in the archives of neurology in the American literature. They found a large tumor in his right orbital frontal cortex. They took the tumor out. The urges went away, and he lived perfectly normally again. He then, some years later, experienced again these urges and again acted on them and again got in trouble and again went in for surgery, and lo and behold, the tumor had come back. They took it out. The urges went away. What's your judgment of his responsibility for the inappropriate touching? Is he excused? Because, of course, a tumor is something none of us can control. The tumor clearly caused the urges on which he made his choices to act. Is he thereby excused? James Q. Wilson, long time at Harvard and UCLA, now partially retired on the California coast, used this example and said, resoundingly not. Are you kidding? All of our urges are caused by things that most of us don't control, but the temptation is to think in his case, the urge isn't just caused, he's incapacitated in his control functions in some way. Now, that's a scientific question on which the evidence is not all in. Typically, right orbital frontal disturbances disturb things like abilities to write, abilities to perceive certain drawings, and the like. They do not impact impulse control. But if someone is willing to say, as unfortunately the University of Virginia psychiatrists and neurologists were willing to say, they thought it impacted his impulse control. Well, if they're right, all well and good, we have a relevant incapacitation. But if they're wrong, James Q. Wilson is surely right. He doesn't differ from the rest of us just because we know the causes of his urges. All of your urges are caused too. So let me leave the determinist challenges. Remember, there's three versions. One is that choice is incompatible with being cause, choice is incompatible with being a brain state, or responsibility for choice is incompatible with causation of that choice by factors themselves unchosen. This is mostly philosophical because I'm not one of those who thinks you can argue the other side, namely the scientific question as to whether choice is caused. There are some people who want to say it isn't. I'm just not a libertarian of that kind. They end up being not only libertarians, but they also have to be dualists because they have to insulate the mind from the impact of these physical processes, and I think that's literally unintelligible. If you look at one of Sir John Eccles' charts where he's got mind-brain interface, I have no idea what those lines represent, and neither does he. Okay, so we do need responsibility to be compatible with choice being caused, or indeed we are in just the trouble that Hobbes and many others thought we were a long time ago. It's not that neuroscience shows us anything new in this regard, other than it makes more concrete what the causes are or the factors are that we don't control that cause our choice. Now let me move to the second set of examples, and here I can collapse the three together, which I'm sure you're relieved at, so we don't have to do them separately. There's three objections, all having the same form, the epiphenomenal form, all having the conclusion that something that you thought caused your actions doesn't cause it. The skepticism does not proceed from your choices being caused, it proceeds from your choices doing no causing. That's a serious skepticism not to be put aside just because it's moving to choices doing no causing rather than not being caused. If true, it would be, it looks like, extremely damaging. The reason there's three versions of the argument, because people are unsure where they think the locus of responsibility is. That's a moral question. Is it the case that it's responsible, makes you responsible, if you choose, even if your choice is unconscious? I once wrote a book about that, Cambridge University Press, 1984, out in paperback. It's a hard question, one that Freud raised as well as the neuroscientists. But suppose you think, no, you actually need consciousness of the choice to make you responsible. Then the second form of skepticism regresses the epiphenomenal objection and does this. It says, okay, even if choice causes, consciousness of choice doesn't cause, and that should make you skeptical because consciousness of choice is what you need for responsibility, not just choice. Second form of the epiphenomenal objection. Third form of the epiphenomenal ejection, a little hard to see. It's this. I call it phenomenal awareness of choice is epiphenomenal. You have to think what Freud thought in 1912 in his metapsychological papers, namely there can be an unconscious consciousness, but I think you can make perfectly good sense of that. If you isolate what you mean by consciousness to the phenomenal awareness, purely an experiential phenomenon, and hive it away from the brain process that consciousness surely is, it's a hiving that's artificial in science, but you might want to do it for moral theory because you might want the strongest moral thesis. It's not even consciousness of choice that's necessary for responsibility. It's consciousness in the sense of having a phenomenal awareness at the time you're acting of your intention that makes you responsible. So that's the third sort of skepticism. It would be a skepticism that says, well, phenomenal awareness of your intention does no causing. Three forms of skepticism. Now, the answers to each are the same, which is why I want to collapse them together. The answers are more or less persuasive, depending on which version you have in mind, as I think you'll see as we go through them. So let me do the three answers. Answer number one comes from Al Mealy's book, a philosopher at Florida State, but many of us argued it as well. It's a direct answer to Wegener's book because, as I recall, the title of Mealy's book is Effective Intentions, The Power of the Conscious Will. Mealy. It is no argument at all that choice is in an epiphenomenal position, that it simply succeeds in time, whatever is going on in the supplementary motor area of the brain measured by the readiness potential, or whatever is going on in the precuneus. His example, homely one. Suppose someone lights a fuse at T1 and there's an explosion at T3. Suppose what succeeds the lighting of the fuse at T1 is the burning of the fuse at T2. The succession of the burning to the lighting is no argument whatsoever that the burning is not part of the causal process from the lighting to the explosion. Temporal order says nothing about where in the causal chain an intermediate event stands. What you need is evidence showing that choice stands outside that chain. So there are brain events, there are choices, and there are actions that could simply be a simple causal chain. And remember, the skepticism here is not that choices are caused, they are. But that they'd also cause in the chain is the answer to an epiphenomenal objection. So evidence is needed as to why choice is in the dangler position rather than simply in the intermediate position in a causal chain. Now that sounds pretty damning. The problem is the evidence is hard to get. Live it to the present day. The way in which you isolate the readiness potential, unfortunately, is by back averaging at least 25 to 40 trials and eliminating enough noise in order to see it. In which event, the thing you would like to test this, which is, can you get a readiness potential that, in fact, doesn't need an intention, is hard to do. It may be one of the grants we gave to the University of California, Santa Barbara, Mike Gazzaniga's group, is a grant to see how much they can pare down the noise so that we don't need this many trials, this many runs. If they succeed, maybe we can get some more direct evidence. But at the moment, the evidence looks pretty inconclusive one way or the other, and for reasons we understand, it's hard to get. There are in psychology the stop-action experiments. There are in psychology the veto experiments, where if you tell subjects to veto an otherwise intended movement, they have about 100 to 150 millisecond window in which they can do it, and they do it. You get a spike in the readiness potential, and they intend not to move. It stops it. There's no movement. That's not direct evidence of what you want, because the presence of an intent to veto is not the absence of an intent to move. So it doesn't quite test directly what you would like. It's only suggestive. In spite of the inconclusive evidence, why are people like Daniel Wegener, who's got a nice chair at Harvard, why are they so sure that the kind of Libet to Haynes evidence makes the will epiphenomenal? I think they already have a picture that makes it almost a priori for them. I think they refuse to identify mental states like choice and willing with brain states, and the result is, almost by necessity, it stands outside the ordinary causal process. the ordinary physical process from precuneus through supplementary motor area, presupplementary area, primary motor cortex, down to the motor plates, there's no room for anything else. Unless you can identify willing with one of those steps in the physical process, of course it's a dangler, of course it's epiphenomenal. But that's a priori science. The experimental science would have to take that identity claim seriously and see if indeed the brain state that is willing is or is not in causal position. It's the problem with science. You know, it's hostage to the facts. That's why some of us like to do philosophy. Okay, second sort of skepticism. Second sort of skepticism is one that does the first one, a second sort of answer to skepticism is one that does the first one even better. It says, look, the willing doesn't have to be identified as a causal intermediary. What Libet discovered in the supplementary motor area, or maybe John Dylan Haynes back further, is the actual willing itself. In the supplementary motor area, perhaps what used to be called volitions, in the precuneus, perhaps what used to be called more intentions, but nonetheless, these aren't epiphenomenal danglers. They're not even in the middle of this chain. They're at the beginning, just where you want them to be, if you want someone to look like they're responsible. Now, there's some scientific worries about that one, but the evidence surely isn't in on that either. There's some worries about the time it takes for consciousness to arise. Looks like it's quicker than it would be if the intention's way back there. There's the reaction time experiments where it looks like you can actually move quicker than 550 milliseconds from an external stimulus, more in the 200 millisecond range. But those are people, after all, who've already formed their intent to move. They're just waiting for the external trigger. So none of that is conclusive. There's the colleague of mine at Dartmouth, Walter Sinnott Armstrong, who says basically the consciousness isn't in the same area as the willing. Well, we don't really know where consciousness is, so that remains to be seen, too. The problem with science, as I say, is it's messy. But surely the evidence doesn't say the willing isn't already measured by the readiness potential, and maybe the consciousness, too, although the phenomenal awareness is later. Consciousness is a brain process, too. It takes real time. It's surely going to precede our experience of it. Okay. The third answer is the one I like the best because it leaves the messy contingency of scientific fact for the beautiful and satisfying certainty of moral philosophy. Namely, give the neuroscientists everything they say about the epiphenomenal status of choice, conscious choice, awareness of choice. It still doesn't mean you're not responsible for the actions that you do. That's the burden of this little chart, which looks worse than it is. We had, I think, a duplicate handout, because I think it was at the back of the outline as well. But here's the essential idea in a nutshell. The idea in a nutshell is you can control things you don't cause. Now, it is true that some of us got tenure writing books about the causal theory of action that are still being published, where we think basically most of the time what you control is indeed what you cause. But sometimes it looks like actors can use epiphenomenal forks to bring about events they can't directly cause, can't indirectly cause, and they can't cause them at all. So, take the golf instructor. I don't play golf. I'll give you a skiing example in a minute. Golf instructor says to you, the way to get a square hit on the ball on a tee is to get a good follow-through. Now, when you hear that advice the first time, you think, what has he discovered? Backwards causation? If you got a good follow-through, you thereby cause there to be an earlier hit on the ball? Couldn't be that. It's got to be what I chart on here, an epiphenomenal fork, which is, if you get a good follow-through, that will only be because earlier you had some kind of psychological set that not only causes a good follow-through, but it also causes a square hit. So that you're responsible for getting a square hit if you get one, not because you caused it by this, but by, in fact, this manipulation of an epiphenomenal fork. I used to do competitive skiing. My advice to skiers was the best thing, the thing you most need for ski racers, is a particular way of getting all of your weight on that one edge for hard snow and ice. But if you tell them that, they don't do as well. You know the thing you tell them? It's the downhill arm position. I watched Billy Kidd in the 60s. I decided he's still skiing. He was the guy I couldn't beat, so I quit. if you watch the arm position, if you get the arm right, the legs will follow. Not because the arm causes the legs to move. You can only put the arm in the right position if the legs are already in the right position. In which event, it looks like there are some times we can use epiphenomenal forks to do actions to bring about consequences that we can't cause. Now try a complicated example. Try this one. It's the Patriot example number 2 on this chart. Remember the old story from the American Revolution. 1 if by land, 2 if by sea, Paul Revere is waiting from the signal of the Old North Church in Boston whether he makes his famous ride. Poor guy named Dawes was also waiting, but nobody wrote a poem about him, so you never hear about him. But I put him on the chart anyway. So Dawes and Revere are waiting for the signal. The problem is the Patriot in the Old North Tower has been shot by the British, and he's paralyzed. He can't move his finger to light the lights. He can't, therefore, cause the lights to go off and alert the rebels about which way the British are going. Fortunately, a Patriot neuroscientist is with him and has rigged him up with a Libet device on his brain and explains how the device works. If this is too science fiction-y for you, mind-brain interface machines are now becoming very common. They had a special on 60 Minutes where one of the newscasters tried out one of the machines, and he sat there and thought the letter A, and it typed out A. He said, that's unbelievable. So here's my mind-brain interface machine, primitive. The Patriot says to himself, I can't cause the light to go on, but I can will my finger, which I know won't move because I'm paralyzed, I can will my finger to move, and that will cause, we know, a readiness potential in the supplementary motor area of his brain. Well, sorry, I misspoke. It won't cause it. It will have to be the case that the readiness potential in his brain is alerted in order for him to have the willing of the movement. Suppose you put a light on that, which you then put an amplifier on, and it amplifies the lights of the Old North Church. Revere sees the signal and alerts the British. I think 3 conclusions would be true of the paralyzed Patriot. All true, even though he didn't cause the alerting of the rebels. 1, he did the action of alerting the rebels. 2, he's morally blameworthy for it. And 3, if he's caught by the British, he's fairly hung for treason. He's legally punishable. He is someone who's legally liable, morally responsible, and has performed the action of alerting the rebels, even though he didn't cause them to be alerted, utilizing this epiphenomenal fork. It's also the case in even more complicated examples that I think you can get the same responsibility. This is a famous paradox, and if we had more time, which we surely don't because we're way over the allotted 50 minutes I sort of agreed I'd stop at, but it's a Russian watch. What can you expect? It's, you know. The Newcomb's paradox is a famous paradox, but it basically says you cannot cause someone who's predicting your behavior to make the prediction that you want, because the prediction and the action based on it will be done before you make your decision. So how do you get the prediction that you want? Just make your decision, and if you're any good at prediction, that's what they will have predicted. So if John Dylan Haynes is sitting there and goes up to 99% plus in his predictions, and he's the one who will put $1 million in the old example in a box, if and only if you form a certain intention, you can't cause him, only if and only if he predicts that you form a certain intention, you cannot cause him to have the prediction. What you can do is make your decision. He's already made his prediction, but if he's any good, he will have predicted, given what he's reading in your precuneus, in a way that says, oh, you're going to choose just what I will reward with $1 million, and you'll be a lot richer. It's a, as you can see from the chart, a complicated and controversial piece of philosophy, but it's simply an epiphenomenal fork that you manipulate. Okay. 2 sorts of skepticisms, 3 varieties of each, none of which, at the end of the day, make me in the least skeptical. That we do the actions for the reasons that we think we do them doesn't mean that we don't make mistakes about the reasons, but that there are reasons that are causally efficacious, allowing us to shape the world in answer to our representations, seems to me to be still undeniably true, despite everything neuroscience has said. Still, it does keep some of us employed, and I'm glad to have the employment because I find the science interesting quite apart from this issue. And thank you very much for your patience. My apologies.
thank you, Michael, for your talk. I think I didn't promise too much. I think you delivered on all the points. You gave a very systematic talk on a very complicated matter.
Thank
you. You even showed that you are not only at the height of the philosophical debate, but also in the midst of the scientific debate. So I think you delivered even more than I promised. Now, I understand that you would be willing to take questions.
Sure, absolutely.
Would you like to take them yourself, or shall I?
Go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and guide the responses?
I open the floor for questions. And maybe you could give us your name and your affiliation. You want to break the ice? That's great. Okay.
Me, Egon, first I'm focused on neurotechnology. I'm one of those neuroscientists, let's say.
Do you mind stand up? And I think it will be more easy for the others to hear your question.
You seem to place the argument of making a choice sort of on the outcome of a process. Now, if I gave you the task to, let's say, add up a couple of numbers, and then tell me what the result is. When would you have made the choice on the result? Would that be at the end, or is it not rather the full process that is actually the choice itself and inseparable from the outcome?
So if you
say John Haynes predicted, then the choice making, the process of choosing, is, let's say, 7 seconds long or whatever.
Yeah, that's the difference between the first and the second sort of response, which I think one can be pretty happily indifferent on. Whether you're talking 10 seconds prior to a predictor of choice, or whether you're talking about part of choice, I don't think it changes the skeptical challenge, nor does it change the answer, other than it varies between one and two of the two kinds of answers that I gave. Remember, the only difference was where you put choice. Is a causal intermediary, or is it all the way back? Now, Arthur Danto at Columbia made exactly your response, an analytic philosopher of action. When he first saw the Libet experiments, that choice is all the way through the execution to the motor plates and all the way back to whatever it is Libet is measuring. Perfectly possible.
And that would then get rid of the dilemma. So there is no difference between the process and what the philosophy.
It's one way of answering the epiphenomenal worry for choice. But now we're going to have to do the same thing for those who think it's not choice that's the touchstone of responsibility, bit of moral philosophy, but rather consciousness of choice. Does consciousness go all the way back to 10 seconds prior? And I'm quite willing to think consciousness should be a brain process and not simply talk about phenomenal awareness. But then there are going to be those moralists who say, well, I don't care about the brain process. I want phenomenal awareness, and that's demonstrably not back there at 10 seconds prior. So you're going to get rid of one of the three epiphenomenal objections by your move.
Nobody has a question for now. Maybe I pose one and gives you some more time to think about questions you might have. I think you in the outline of the paper you say everything is well in the end. That's what compatibilists try to tell us. And I find one difficulty in this approach to still make sense of a vocabulary you also use in your explanation of all this phenomena. You talk about control, you talk about choice, you talk about freedom, you talk about willing, consciousness, and it seems to me that it is a vocabulary entrenched with the idea of a non-deterministic environment. Now, the example you got more concrete on was the notion of ability. You said there is a compatibilist reading of the notion of ability, which would not interfere with the supposition of determinism. And but I wonder if this reconstruction of the idea of ability really covers what we presuppose if we use ability to assign a responsibility. And I understand in your notion of ability, to stick at this example, I have the ability to do a certain physical exercise. I can jump 3 meters, but I can't jump 10. So I have the ability to jump 3 meters, but I can't jump 10. Whether I do it in a specific instance is caused by the state of the world and the laws of nature.
Yep.
But it's still sensible to talk and to talk the talk of having the ability to jump 3 meters, even if I.
No, I think this. Are you saying you think this too?
I think. Okay. If that would be my reconstruction, my
yes, I do think this.
Yeah. Yep. But then, what is this sense of ability? What makes us different from a thermostat? Then we can say the thermostat has the ability to show a certain range of degrees. It can measure weight, for example. So whatever measurement the thermostat shows is the instantiation that is caused, that's determined, like me doing the jump or not jumping. But I could still talk about the ability of the thermostat to show another degree than the actual one.
True.
In your sense of ability. But still, we wouldn't hold the thermostat accountable in any moral moral relevant sense for showing a certain measurement. And so, isn't it a too thin a notion of ability to be strong enough to allow us to assign things like moral responsibility?
Good. Well, yeah, I agree with you. We're not going to hold the thermostat responsible, although some of our ancestors did some of those crazy things. You know, the Swiss hung dogs in the 10th century, and the French did the same to rats in the 8th, and my English ancestors used to chop trees up if they fell on people to punish them. But we don't share the primitive animism that has. I raise the stories because they show us that we have something besides ability in our arsenal of dessert determiners. So at one level, I'll give you the flat answer, which is, yeah, thermostats have abilities just like we do, in the sense that there are some things they can do and some things they can't do. It's all a question of ability, capacity, what's possible for them, all of that stuff is fully compatible with determinism for them and for us. But of course, the way they exercise their ability does not include representational states. They can't represent the world, at least as best we know. They don't have the capacities to represent the world in a form of a practical syllogism and conform the world to the conclusion of that syllogism. We do. Even though that's also caused, that representational capacity is what makes us more responsible than thermostats, not a difference in the two kinds of ability. So I'm quite willing to say, in a sense, sure, they have the same ability to do. I mean, we're just machines too. Question is what we can do and what they can do. We can do more. You know why we can do more? We can actually represent the world in a certain way. I'm not one of those who's a carbonist, you know, sort of a speciesist. If our silicone-based brothers and sisters can have the same capacities as us to represent the world in a certain way, my God, we better admit them to citizenship.
You would say if the thermostat has self-awareness, then you would hold it responsible.
Well, and the seven attributes I gave you, give him those seven, and I'm going to put a suit on him.
Yes, I'm not sure I have a question or maybe a comment. My name is Ad Artsen, I'm a neuroscientist, and amongst others I try to build brain-machine interfaces. So I think the job of neuroscientists is not to bring up challenges, but rather to understand the brain. The ones that interpret this as challenges are the others. Right? So I was never surprised by the Libet experiment, because I think the only thing it shows is that there is a point in using your brain. Right? And there is actually not much else that you can do if you want to act in the world. And the rest is debate. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd say that you sat through a lecture to which you already knew the conclusion. Namely, I just proved to you that 2 and 2 is 4. You're quite right. If I were a neuroscientist, I'd say what you said. I wouldn't be writing books like The Illusion of Conscious Will. I'd actually be doing the neuroscience. Building mind-brain interface machines is not only interesting, it's really useful. But there's an awful lot of people, some of whom are neuroscientists, who think that they've unlocked the key at long last to show us that we are not responsible and that retributive punishment has to go away. One of those was our founder, Sapolsky, this biologist. Nobel Prize winning biologist who must be very disappointed that we think 2 and 2 is 4. He thinks it's 5. But anyway, I'm glad you agree. Sorry to bore you.
That's not what I meant.
Further comments or questions? Well,
it's amazing to be that persuasive, isn't it?
Right. And you only have 50 minutes. What would happen if I would have given you the 90 minutes to ask it? Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, I think then it probably has to do with the amount of information you have given to the audience, and I think they still have to kind of reorganize it for themselves. We will have an occasion for that out at the lobby, where we will present some wine and some little bits to eat, and you can have a conversation in smaller groups. So, but before we would head out there, I would thank you again, Michael, for coming to Freiburg.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And we heard in your talk that you visited about all the very famous universities of the world. And it's not that Freiburg is shy of any comparison, but it's one thing that seems to be especially very special about Freiburg. I think it's one of the few universities in the world that has its own vineyards.
Mm.
And so I would like to give you one of the best things these vineyards produce.
Wow, very nice.
As a present for your talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's a very fitting present. My colleagues in America would know what a perfectly fitting present this is. Thank you again.
Well, thank you for coming, and please join us outside.